powered by the people.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Good memories are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, a union town.
Good morning, and welcome to another Working Week. This is KPFK's Working Voices. I'm Jamie Campbell from OPIU, Office and Professional Employees International Union Local 30. And in this morning's show, our executive producer Dan McCrory brings us an interview with International Longshore Workers Union Local 56 President Albert Ramirez. Brother Ramirez's local performs some thankless duties in the port of Los Angeles and around town. Robert Arnold, at first glance, is a good old boy from Arkansas, but he's TikTok's newest sensation. And he calls out those in power with the eloquence of a poet. We have pieces from Working Voices regulars, Steve Zeltzer and Enrique Sanchez. Steve talks with Mark Norberg, part of a coalition trying to pass single-payer health care. Enrique interviews actor Daniel Villarreal. All this and more coming up this morning on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. This is Working Voices.
Working Voices' Dan McCrory interviewed Albert Ramirez of the Longshoremen's Union, ILWU Local 56, about the duties his local performs to make our city and our ports cleaner, safer places.
This is Dan McCrory for Working Voices talking to Albert Ramirez, president of Local 56, right?
Yes, ILWU Local 56. We do environmental hazmat and soup scaling work.
And what does that entail, Albert?
Well, historically, our name is Ship Scalers and Painters Union. And historically, that title goes back probably back to the 1920, where we literally scaled ships, scraping the barnacles and painting ships here at the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach. It was like Todd Shipyard, Marston Shipyard. Now it's really environmental hazmat, oil, and emergency spill response, from lithium batteries to cleaning, homeless encampments, to cleaning up oil spills. We typically do that type of a scope of work on the waterfront and in other parts of Southern California.
Let's rewind a little bit. You said homeless camps?
Yeah, occasionally homeless encampments, because I think that was actually one of my first jobs, where you're cleaning up bio waste, you know, collecting needles and just kind of sorting out and cleaning out areas. So that's one bucket of work. But other types of work also include oil spills and sorting through hazardous materials for proper disposal. So really the dirty nitty-gritty of the work, so to speak.
Typically, who hires you for work like this?
That's a good question. So we, with Local 56, we have four employers, four signatories, as we call it. We have Patriot Environmental Services, owned by Crystal Clean. And then we have Republic Services, NRC. We have ANCOM Marine and Ocean Blue Environmental Services. So we have four signatories that are signed with ILWU Local 56, our collective bargaining agreement. And typically we're dispatched 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's always a spill. There's always some routine maintenance work. And work hits our hall, and our dispatcher dispatches work to our rank and file to the given work site or the employer's yard, so to speak, and go to work. The employer will call us. We have something called marine work and industrial work. Marine work obviously speaks for itself. near the water, on the water, connected to ship parts. Industrial, though, that is like a may or shall, depending on our collective bargaining agreement. Typically is work outside of the Port of LA and the Port of Long Beach, like refineries, adjacent to a freeway, you know, some sort of industrial site that needs cleaning, et cetera, et cetera. So in good faith with the employers, vice versa, we are in communication to find these increased employment opportunities. So it's a working relationship with employers. We see eye on everything now. But with our four signed agreements and enforcing our contracts and servicing our contracts, you know, we want to make sure that we safeguard our work, our jurisdiction, and just keep building this relationship with employers. Whether it's oil, natural gas, whether it's some sort of chemical, something, I guess you could say it's just hazardous, there is going to be work. I think with like methane, this is before my administration, but I know that there was like methane spill several years ago, and our workers had to go out there and literally clean homes outside. Our members actually worked in the Palisades fires in phase one. And, you know, that was by Republic Services NRC inviting us to work. So there's always going to be some sort of dangerous chemical. There's always going to be some sort of emergency response that will require our type of work, or our type of labor to address that. From, you know, there's always going to be something, whether it's motor oil, whether it's some sort of pesticide or some sort of chemical. We want to protect the environment and our surrounding communities. So we will respond occasionally if it's like cleaning oil pipelines or whatnot, or pressure washing, you know, that is our type of work as well. So very versatile. And at the same time, you know, we want to make sure that our rank file is safe and we reduce exposure to many of these, chemicals that are out there.
What's the call you hate the most to get?
It is a good, like, I wouldn't say there's a bad thing. Like, our members are always hungry for it. And whether it's tank work or industrial or a ship tie up or, you know, cleaning a barge or boom work, like cleaning, oils or scraping or pressure washing, it's never a dull moment. I think, like, this is something new. Like, it's every day or every other day when you pick up a job, it's something different. Whether you're pressure washing, whether you're doing a little ship tie up, throwing sandbag, blowing out absorbing carpet, or in a ship. I think there's a level of like, this is something new and something that we need to make sure that we're safe. I don't know. I think sometimes like the tremendous heat, because you're in these confined spaces where it's hot, it is smelly, it's sometimes loud. I think that's kind of like, you know, those jobs are just like, okay, I just got to mentally prepare myself or ourselves to do that scope of work. But honestly, I think it's always something new and something different, something exciting. Just kind of getting comfortable with like confined spaces, like enclosed spaces, or really the heights or whatnot, and just the intensity and the long days. And I think I, as an officer, you know, I'm usually in the in the administrative component, but it's sometimes, you know, we're working officers, we'll pick up a couple of jobs here and there, and you know, you don't want to forget how to do the job, so. It's always going to be in the field.
What do you think our listeners would find surprising about what you do?
It depends, because as an officer, you know, we're servicing our contracts. I think what's surprising is this the enormity of our industry. You know, from my knowledge, I think it's about 10% that's unionized. The other 90% is up for grabs for organizing and unionizing. I think perhaps there's just so much opportunity for work, whether it's the Olympics, whether it's DDT, DDX off the coast of San Pedro that needs to be cleaned up. I think the sky's the limit. And because of climate change and, you know, the forever plastics and how much science and biology and chemistry and how much is involved with our type of work. And then our frontline workers, which are rank and file, remediating and addressing contaminants, whether it's in the water and soil, cleaning equipment. I'm never surprised or shocked the type of work that is out there. I'm never surprised. I'm very proud of my rank and file always stepping up to do the type of work to protect our environment, coastline, and soil, And I think it's always something different, something new. And, ensuring that members go home, after a long day at work. So I think that's what, with the shockingness, I will say this, what is kind of interesting is that how much non-union or hazmat companies are just popping up left and right, and how you can basically start a hazmat company, get a license, get rent equipment, and call yourself a hazmat company. But we have really great signatories, and I think they uphold the standard in the industry because of our collective bargaining agreements. And, we see a lot of non-union. I think there's probably about 19 that come to mind and are not signatories to Local 56 of ILW. But our doors are open if they wish to sign with us and build that partnership. But right now, it is kind of indicative of the industry, how non-union or non-signatory can just perfectly quickly. It's fairly regulated in the state of California from my understanding. And, folks stick around. I think, folks come to the hall. I think it's just very expensive to operate, such machinery, technology, and, the permits and the licenses and the fees, so to speak. So, but folks typically stick around.
You mentioned the Olympics. Have you already got an assignment covering the Olympics?
No, unfortunately not. We're still building those relationships and we're still having those conversations. There is a hazmat company called Clean Harbors. They're very much a dominant force in hazmat, whether it's with the city of LA or parts of other municipalities. We see an opportunity to build that bridge with them. But at the same time, since they're not a signatory to ILW-6, it's for them to try to come into the waterfront and undermine our CBAs that we have with ANCON, Ocean Blue, NRC, or Patriot. That's a non-starter. We want to make sure that we protect our CBAs, protect our jurisdiction, uplift six standards and whatnot. But we have really great leadership here in District 15 and LA City Council District 15. The Councilman Tim McCosker has been a blessing, really been a champion for Local 56, as well as other elected officials like Supervisor Janice Hong, Congresswoman Bahagan, Assembly Member Mike Gibson. The list goes on, and we have the Harbor Commission here, really, really ensuring that, our contracts are protected and that we start looking at policy to really uplift the standards for working families with respect to hazmat. So our doors are open to stenographers. If you want to sign, great. If not, we're still going to keep supporting our signatories and working with our elected officials. And we're so proud of our partnership with our elected officials here in Southern California.
Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know about your particular local, ILWU?
We're proud of our rich history of Local 56, with ILW Local 56. We're very grateful to all the ILW locals that have been tremendous support with us in the last 4 years as we strengthen our contracts. We're grateful to the International, the ILWU, just providing the resources, our organizing team, led by organizing director Ryan Dowling, who is just a blessing, a fighter, and ensuring that we bargain and we sign these contracts and we fight for these contracts, and our legal counsel, Lindsay Nicholas, our general counsel, as well as our other legal team, the O'Doons here at the court, really is a concerted effort. We have really strong organizing. We have great attorneys. Our research and our other type of officers of the ILWU, Sheriff Docs, really looking out for local businesses. Really just ensuring that hazmat shift scalers, have worked well into the 21st century. And, we're very proud of our rich history. And, we're very hopeful for the future and ensuring that, there's going to be work for the ILWU for generations to come. And, you know, we're very hopeful and excited for Local 56. But yeah, we're very blessed to have the support of so many folks, elected, ILWU, international, other locals, and just folks in the community. So we're very blessed, very grateful. And as president, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm very blessed. And we had to say gratitude to people because, it wasn't an easy fight. It always wasn't like this. And I think, that's a testament to the leadership of the international and the tenacity of our rank and file. So, we welcome folks to check out our union hall in San Pedro. We're off of 7th Street. And, you know, you can always reach out to us and learn more about our neighborhood.
Thanks, Albert, for your time and for enlightening us on what it is your members do. If you have any issues in the future, please don't hesitate to reach out to KPFK Working Voices, and we'll be there to cover what you're up to.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it. And thanks to KPFK and all the work that you do. And we appreciate that solidarity and support.
That was Dan McCrory speaking with President Albert Ramirez of ILWU Local 56.
Now we never get paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in the days on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about. And now we never get paid what our labor is worth. That's why we often in the days on the way to our work. And when we get there, we can't wait to be out. So let me tell you what it's about.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
Mark Nordberg, chair of California United for Single Payer, spoke with Steve Zeltzer prior to an event they're hosting in Sacramento on the 20th.
This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek, and we have covered the struggle around healthcare, the situation of strikes by healthcare workers and educators around the issue of healthcare. And joining us today is Mark Nordberg, and he's involved in organizing a statewide rally for healthcare in Sacramento. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, Steve. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for giving my group an opportunity to share the work that we're doing.
Great. So why don't you talk about your organization? And
sure. Thank you. So I'm the chair of California United for Single Payer, CUSP, that is our acronym. And the CalCare bill that's been introduced by Ash Cholera, he introduced it about 2 years ago. And at that point, I was working with educators for Single Payer. I'm heavily involved with my union, and this was a group of teachers. And we got hooked up with Healthcare for Us and a number of other organizations and just sort of a loose coalition to fight for that CalCare bill 2 years ago. And there was a lot of energy and excitement over it. We really felt that we had the votes. We were working with the California Nurses Association. The bill went to the healthcare committee. It passed the healthcare committee, and then it went to the appropriations committee. And we're like, here we go. And it was crushed in committee by Buffy Wicks. And all that year plus of organizing, I mean, we were assured it was going to get to the floor and that we had the votes, and we were devastated. And we really had no plan B, and we kind of licked our wounds for a while. And then after about 6 months, we said, okay, let's get together and let's figure out what we want to do, because we can't. This was like the fifth or sixth time a healthcare bill had come to the state and been crushed by one political organization or another. And so we met, we had a big summit last September, and we were hoping, we were just inviting organizers. We were hoping to get 20 organizers to show up, and 70 organizers showed up. We had a whole all-day summit. We broke into teams and really talked about what are we going to do. And what came out of that summit was we need to formalize an alliance between our groups. We don't need a new organization to fight for healthcare. We've got the people, but we're not coordinating with each other. So we drafted bylaws, and we formed California United for Single Payer. And there's a few simple rules. First, in order to join, you have to be approved by 2/3 of the board. You have to agree to a few foundational principles. Number one, that we will not discuss any solutions that include for-profit healthcare insurers or entities, right? We are only going to fight for publicly funded healthcare solutions. You have to agree that and understand that is the Democrat Party that is stopping this. The Democrat Party is our opponent, and we're going to be calling them out. We're going to call out the Democrat Party, and we're going to call out individuals. And then the third thing is anything, any initiative that's brought to our group that gets two-thirds support, it has to get two-thirds to pass. All members have to agree to support it, even if you didn't vote for it. We want to be all for one and one for all kind of organization where you've got some skin in the game. And we opened our doors about 3 months ago to you know, officially welcome people into the organization. And in that time, 12 organizations have joined our group. Healthcare for Us, Feel the Burn, San Fernando Valley, PNHP Santa Barbara, that's a health a physicians group, Hollywood for CalCare, that comes out of the Actors Union, Educators for Single Payer, that was a group I'm involved with, the IDEA Alliance, they fight for special education funding, San Gabriel Valley Progressives, Jewish and Allied Educators for Palestine, the San Joaquin Valley Democratic Club, Democratic Socialists of America, Santa Barbara, and Asian Pacific Islanders for CalCare. And you'll notice there's a few groups in there that are aligned with the Democrat Party. And what we found was there's immense anger within Democrat ranks, and people were willing to join us and say, heck yeah, I'm willing to join this and call out my own party. We collectively represent 6,275 members. So one of the things we agree to is when we have an initiative, when we send information out, everybody sends it to their entire database, and everybody makes a good faith effort to, you know, if it's a boots on the ground kind of thing, bring people there. One thing about our alliance is we're willing to work with anybody. So you don't.
Question I have is, you know, the your union, I think you're a member of the CTA and the California Nurses Association, National Nurses Union. Yes. Say they're for single payer. They support single payer. Where are they in this coalition?
CTA and the NEA and the Cal Nurses. They're very much believe in the inside game that the Democrat Party can be negotiated with.
But and, I mean, why wouldn't they want a mobilization of their members? I know I've been covering nurses strikes where nurses are fighting for health care. I mean, it's crazy, but, you know, healthcare workers don't have health care. Mm-hmm. They negotiate. Teachers have been fighting in San Francisco for healthcare. That's been a major issue on the bargaining table. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that issue of single payer, everyone getting healthcare, taking it off the bargaining table would be a no-brainer for those unions that are facing fights themselves over healthcare.
Yes, you would think. I can't speak for the California Nurses Association, but I am a member of the CTA and I'm heavily involved in it. And what I can tell you is that union leadership is heavily aligned with the Democrat Party. So we've lost the mindset that unions are adversarial, right? That the way you win is you confront power and you get power to fear you, right? That has changed. Kashama Sawant has a really great term. She calls it business unionism. Mm-hmm. And what's happened over the years is unions went from, like, I mean, you look at the history of unions, like, it was like violence, right? At first, like, people were putting their lives on the line going against companies. Now it's, we get a seat at the table with them, right? We sit down with them, and if we are nice enough and we give good enough arguments, they'll give us things. And that's where they're at. It is really frustrating talking to union leadership about the need to confront this. They just won't do it. Now that's changing. There are more and more people inside the union, like myself, which is like, we need to divorce ourselves from this party.
Even if you don't divorce yourself from the Democratic Party, which I in favor of the Labor Party, but wouldn't you want to mobilize your members who are fighting over these very issues? Here you are. That's one of your issues. Why wouldn't you say we need single payer to get it off the table and to fight these corporations, HMOs, who are basically ripping us off?
Yeah, no, there's it's really maddening. There's three big reasons. One is they are heavily aligned with the establishment. So they want access to power. They're having, you know, at the national level, they're having dinner at the White House. I mean, they're rubbing elbows with really powerful people, and they're not going to be in the union forever, and they want jobs, right? There's opportunities if you show the Democrat Party that you're a team player. Number two is that there's, you would think that union leadership would know what single payer is. I'm a member of the Badass Teachers Caucus, right? we're a caucus within CTA. One of the things that the caucuses do is when somebody's running within the union, you have to interview with the caucuses. We ask for any level within the union, you know, do you support single payer? I would say 99% of the candidates, the people that are that interview, that are running for leadership, they will say, to be honest, I don't really understand what it is. There is huge lack of understanding of what single payer is and why it would transform our lives.
But the question I have is, these unions on the record for single payer, they say that they're for it. They put out publicity. They put out articles. Why haven't they had an education campaign, even among their own members, to educate them about why we got to get rid of private control of healthcare?
Support for single payer is CTA policy now because of educators for single payer and people within the union like myself. We got that policy. But the leadership, like the ultimate power within the union lies with the body. There's, I'm a state delegate and we meet four times a year. We can override the leadership if you bring someone to the floor. But there's this huge institutional tradition of you follow leadership. Leadership, for these reasons, doesn't really want it. A lot of them just don't understand it. And this is a little insidious. There is a fear within union leadership that if single payer passes, that's one less reason to join a union. Because what's something you always hear about universal healthcare? It's like, well, I have union negotiated healthcare, so I don't need to fight for single payer. There are a lot of people think their union negotiated healthcare is better than single payer. And union leadership believes, I think, that if we get that, it's one less something, one less thing that will appeal to people to join the union.
Isn't that a capitalist ideology?
Totally. I mean, unions that we have, the business unionism is a real problem. We have, like, the NEA is the largest labor union in the world. We have infrastructure second to none. We are embedded in every community from coast to coast and as some of its most trusted members. If the NEA, this is the National Education Association, if the NEA wanted to, it could be leading this country in the fight for universal healthcare. We could be doing it right now. I'm fighting these fights all the time inside the union. One reason I'm doing this is because I'm really getting frustrated with fighting within my own people. And so, you know, California United for Single Payer, this allows me to have the fight just directly with the establishment. I don't have to go through bureaucracy just to get outside of the union to have these fights. So nobody was organizing. It's poor leadership. It's people not understanding the power that we have. I think it's people overestimating the power of the Democrat Party. And it's going to take members, grassroots members, and those of you that are in unions, it's going to take you getting involved with your union and pushing and shouting out these things and demanding that the unions get on board. I think a lot of it is, again, members sitting back and allowing the leadership to steer the ship, and they're not steering it in the right direction.
And it's an emergency situation with the cutbacks in Medicaid, the end of the insurance subsidies for ACA. 3.4 million people are going to lose Medicaid in California. Cutbacks in public health system. What are the conditions now for working people, poor people in California, as far as getting health care? Because these cutbacks are going to mean that people will probably die because they can't get health care.
Right. No, there's massive problems right now. So I'm just looking at some statistics right now. Like, over 3,000 people die every year in just in California because of lack of health care. Nationally, it's something like over 45,000. 60% of bankruptcies, 60% of personal bankruptcies are medically related. 60%. Our costs are out of control, like you were saying. We pay double what any other country pays for worse outcomes. And here's another really, from, you know, doctors used to not be on board, right? With this, the nurses always were, but doctors were like, I don't know. Now they're on board because of the paperwork and the expenses to them. In 2022, 30% of healthcare providers said they were getting 10% of their claims denied. 2024, just 2 years later, that jumped to 38%. We're saying 10% were getting denied. Now it's at 41% of healthcare providers are saying 10% of their claims are being denied. It's insane. So I think it is important to just explain like why single payer will solve all these problems, because there's still a lot of misinformation. So right now we live in a multi-payer system. You go to your doctor, right? And there are a multiple number, thousands maybe, of insurance companies they might apply to get refunded. They got to find out, are you in our network? Which insurance company is it, right? It's multi-payers. The single payer bill keeps all the medical providers still private. So your doctor, the clinics, the hospitals, they're still privately owned and operated. But it eliminates all the insurance companies and creates a single publicly funded insurance plan. So when you go into your doctor, there's no insurance company between you and your doctor. You and your doctor and you and your doctor alone make the decisions on what you need. It is dealt with. He can refer you to anybody. There's no more in-network, out-of-network. You can go to any doctor you want, any clinic, any hospital. They have to take you. And when you go in, you sit with the doctor, you get what you need, and you leave. You don't see a bill. You see nothing. There's no copays. There's no deductibles. Nothing. And it is fully comprehensive. It covers everything. CalCare, the bill we're fighting for, the nurses union helped write it. Like, they do deserve a lot of credit for pushing this.
What does it say to the politicians? Because the politicians get their money from these unions. They get their support from these unions, WICs and other people. They're supported by unions. This is a reform of the system to have single payer. Canada, they have single payer. Other countries, they have single payer. I mean, is it that radical to have national health care or single payer?
No, it's not. I mean, 90%, like something like 90% of Californians want it. It's not radical. But our political system, the Democrat Party, is not run by unions. It's run by corporations. Yes, the unions give money, but they do it for access. They don't do it for control, because the
corporations... Like April Verrett, who's now president of the National SEIU, was controller of the California Democratic Party. Aren't these people embedded in the Democratic Party?
Totally. But the power comes from corporations. It's corporations that control these parties. They don't listen. They do not stay awake. There's no politician that stays awake.
But I mean, look, SEIU has 750,000 members.
Say that again?
TA has, what, 325,000 members in California. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Isn't that enough membership to have your own party, to have a labor party?
Yes. Yes, all this is true. We could be leading the way in a third party of labor. We could be doing all of this, but the leadership is so embedded and so, I mean, this is decades and decades of training, right? The people that rise to leadership, these are very carefully cultivated people that are not going to rock the boat, right? So by the time you become president or vice president or treasurer or head of a committee, you've already been pre-screened. Like, I'll never, ever be a rise to leadership in the union. I am considered a crazy radical, but it's decades of the mindset that you follow leadership. And look, most people, they're not bad people. They honestly believe that they're doing the right thing. They honestly believe. I've had these conversations. They'll say to me, Mark, I agree with what you're saying, but you have to be a realist. The fact of the matter is the Democrat Party is in charge. They have 2/3 majorities. It's not changing. And if we don't align with the Democrat Party, then we get nothing. That's their mindset. And this idea that I believe, like, we can kick them out. We leave them and form our own party. We don't even have to be big enough. We don't have to be as big as a Democrat Party. We just have to be big enough where they can't win without us. But
well, the base of the Democratic Party in California are the trade unions. Without the trade unions and the labor movement, where would the Democratic Party be?
It's maddening. And members need to speak up and start putting pressure, because as long as members are sitting back and going, well, the leadership must know what it's doing, this is the world that we're in. And we are sitting on the power to change it right now. We have the power to change the state, and we better use it or we're going to lose it.
Thanks for joining us, Mark.
Thank you, Steve, so much. Thank you for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Great.
That was Steve Zeltzer speaking with Mark Nordberg of CUSP, California United for Single Payer. For more information about CUSP, you can find them on Instagram at CUSP_HQ or on their website, www.cuspcoalition.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
Si porque te quiero, quieres llorona que yo.
Enrique Sanchez speaks with actor Daniel Villarreal.
This afternoon, we have a very special guest. Can you introduce yourself to the audience, please?
My name is Daniel Villarreal, and I'm mainly known as an actor.
Welcome. Thank you for being on the show. So I know that you were in the movie American Me. So explain a little bit your background on how you got into acting.
All right. Well, I started out as a photographer when I was 14. I had a mentor. I had a very, very nice person who took an interest in me, which is something that, you know, since then and now I always encourage people to, especially kids, to find someone. And so my mentor, he taught me photography, and then he introduced me to a writer who worked for the Spanish newspaper in LA called La Opinión. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Alberto Macias, would go to concerts and review, shows. Mm-hmm. So he would take me along with him. So by the time I was 16, I was doing that, taking photos at concerts. And by doing that, having a camera in the late 70s got you into a lot of places. Mm-hmm. People understood you were press. Mm-hmm. So I would go to almost anything I could get into every day. And I met a lot of people. I met a lot of people in L.A. who were in the arts. So eventually, people started taking pictures of me and began including me in what they were doing. So mm-hmm. that's how I ended up in front of the camera mm-hmm. performing. And that is how I met Ramon Menendez, who would be the guy that ended up directing Stand and Deliver. Mm-hmm. I met him before he did that movie. And he gave me a job working on that film in the production of that. Mm-hmm. And that led to me being in the movie.
So in the movie Stand and Deliver, did you have like a minor role or were you like a supporting actor?
Well, I ended up having a pretty good role that to this day people remember. And that is how I met Edward James Olmos, who would then cast me mm-hmm. in American Me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember when I saw the movie Stand and Deliver, it was a very positive film because, as you know, Hispanic students struggle a lot to get their education. And what I liked about the character teacher in Stand and Deliver is that, what was his name again? The actor?
Jaime Escalante.
Jaime Escalante, yes. Yeah. He fought for his students, especially when everyone in the school system thought that all of his students were going to be failures in life. He helped them, all of them, graduate high school and go to college.
There's systems and the way systems work, and we all fall into that, meaning like the school system, the districts, they're all very much controlled by a certain kind of, environment.
Right.
And Jaime Escalante went against that. And so it takes people like him and like my mentor that have, an interest in being something more than just what is supposed to be the norm.
Right, of course. And I do believe that Hispanics, particularly the young, have a lot of potential, but they have to be pushed. And I feel that if there isn't enough mentors or leaders or positive role models they could look up to, there is nothing shameful about having a humble job. Mm-hmm. But you have to compete, for higher wages. So I feel that the only way Hispanics, especially the younger generation, could have better opportunities is through education. So I always...
A formal education is good, but I think we have to be aware of, the environment and where things are headed. Because there's a lot of people right now that have degrees and don't have a job.
Right.
So having a degree is not the end all. is being able to survive and to have a position that matters. So you have to be aware of what's coming, you know, and where to connect to. You know, like if you don't have education in like, you know, AI or fields related to like dealing with countries like China, you know, you're not going to do well. You know, there's a lot of people who are out of work. You know, there's kids now that have their own universe, which centered around social media. Mm-hmm. But kids are really smart.
Oh, I know.
And this is something that Escalante understood. You know, he would say, all you need is ganas. You just have to awaken something in not just children, but in people, a desire to learn. Mm-hmm. And then they can accomplish, like he said in the movie, you can accomplish great things.
So the next question I wanted to ask you is the one about the movie American Me. Mm-hmm. So how did you get cast into American Me?
All right. To put it in perspective, we have to talk about, like you said, we have to talk about Stand and Deliver, mm-hmm. which was such a positive experience.
Right.
It made, at the end, it made everybody feel really good.
Right.
About being Latino.
Right.
So then Eddie almost comes and he says, we're going to make this movie about this group of people. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, really? Everybody's going to hate us.
Oh, goody.
But getting involved in the process of making that film, I realized how important it was to make this film. Mm-hmm. And that buried inside that film is a positive message that people didn't see. Very positive story about American Me, if people see the movie and they have come to realize it now, is that something happens to the main character because he changes.
Mm-hmm.
In the movie, he writes a letter to the woman, and he says to her, you opened my eyes. Like, being in touch with her changed who he was, and the bad guys saw this and saw it as a weakness. Mm-hmm. And so that got him killed, but it actually released him and made him a better person.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So I have a question. In the movie American Me, was the movie like a fictionized version of what happened in St. Quentin, or was it based on something that actually happened and they changed it around?
Well, actually, American Me is sort of loosely based on the Mexican Mafia, mm-hmm. which originated at Folsom Prison.
That's a youth correctional facility, right?
That is maximum security prison. It's mm-hmm. for, you know, the baddies go there.
Mm-hmm.
San Quentin is where they made another movie called Blood In, Blood Out.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different prison.
Right.
Yeah, and that is a fictional group in that movie called La Onda.
Right.
Yeah. So Eddie almost talked to the main guys. He had meetings with corrections, and he had meetings with the guy, Joe Morgan,
mm-hmm.
who was the real leader of the Mexican Mafia.
Right.
So there was an agreement so that we could film at Folsom and be safe.
Right.
Yeah, we had an okay.
So how long did it take to make the movie?
The movie took 9 weeks, and we were at Folsom for 3 weeks.
So what was the experience to be like in an actual prison, like filming the scenes and interacting mm-hmm. with the people?
For those of you who are, you know, in the arts and you're writers, you want to be filmmakers or you are actors, there is something about being in a real place
mm-hmm.
that is nothing like when you read the script, the story. Mm-hmm. That's like a jumping point
right.
for when you actually get there. It's so different. Obviously it's not something that I would ever wish upon anyone to end up in a place like that.
Mm-hmm.
When we got there, I was in a cell for one day, during the day only, mm-hmm. and that was enough. You can't even imagine, you know, like when you walk in this room,
right?
In here, we're in here, it's lit
right.
by a certain energy.
Right.
Well, a place like that has a certain energy. And when you absorb the energy of a place like that, oh boy, there's so much, you know, pain in that place. It's dehumanizing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't, you belong to the system.
I know that the movie American Me was also controversial. So like there was some instances where there were like threats to Mr. Olmos's life and to some of the production crew. Could you explain what caused that?
I'll tell you from my end, what I know is that, as I would say to you, we had meetings with people and there were agreements, you know,
mm-hmm.
and we were safe when we were there. And what happened is that we had people working on the film who were consultants
mm-hmm.
and they were associated, and things happened to them due to their own association.
Right.
Not because of our movie, it's because of their lifestyle.
Right, of course.
And so because they were connected to the film, they thought it was about the film.
Right.
The only thing that I would think that was real due to the film was that the main guy that is portrayed in the film, the white guy,
mm-hmm.
he died. He had cancer.
Right.
And the people that took over after him wanted to have their own agreement
mm-hmm.
with Mr. Olmos, and mm-hmm. that's what that was about.
So would you say that the movie, aside from portraying the human side of prison, would you say that the movie also was successful in the terms that it gave a message to the youth that may want to experiment with that lifestyle?
Well, I don't, you know, as I said, like, because I'm community-based, I don't really look at things that way.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as it's all a continuation of where we started and where we're going, and then addressing everything that happens within our community. And that thing that happens where young men end up in prison is a system. It's about power.
Mm-hmm.
It's a power structure. You know, for profit prisons,
mm-hmm.
huge business. And then if you really wanted to get into it, those people that the conglomerates, the people that have stock in for profit.
Right.
You can trace them back to the slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
The same kind of human beings.
Right.
And they're doing it right now with the deportations. People are not being sent to other countries. They're being housed all over this nation. You see it in the news. A lot of cities are saying you're not going to build a detention center here. It's big money. Big, big, big money. Who is profiting? And then you go back to, you know, as conspiracies go,
mm.
people like Miller,
mm.
who is the architect of this whole deportation mm. thing, he owns stock in a lot of those companies.
Mm.
He's profiting.
So anyway, I want to tell you, we come to the end of our time.
Okay.
But I want to tell you, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. And for all of my listeners in Spanish United, we are on all social media platforms. We are on Spanish United, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, now and now known as X, YouTube. Thank you
yeah,
so much.
And thank you for having me and support everything that you do. And then also, anybody who wants to get in touch with me, I'm also on Facebook and Instagram, and you can find me usually on weekends at Frank & Son in Perfect. The City of Industry.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you so much, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
That was Enrique Sanchez speaking with Danielle Villarreal. Robert Arnold looks like many of his neighbors in Little Rock, Arkansas, but when he speaks out on the injustices of the world, the words flow out in the Southern accent that almost sounds like poetry. The power is in the content.
The war drums always sound the same. They began quietly, almost polite. A few carefully chosen words in a briefing room, a few maps held up on a television screen. A few confident men explaining that the world is complicated and that ordinary people wouldn't understand the necessity of what's about to happen. And then, bombs fall. And the men who order those bombs rarely feel the heat of them. They sit in cooled offices with polished wood desks and flags behind them. They speak of strategy and deterrence and the necessity of strength. They use words like stability and security, words that sound noble until you realize they're being spoken over the distant echo of explosions. But the truth is much simpler. Wars of necessity announce themselves. They come when there is no other path left to take. Wars of choice, however, arrive dressed in rhetoric. This one came wrapped in promises that it would never happen. Promises that the United States would no longer chase regime change across deserts and mountains. Promises that American sons and daughters would not be used as pieces on a geopolitical chessboard. Promises that our country would finally turn inward and repair the fractures running through our towns and cities. But here we are again. Another war, another open question with no answer at the end of it. And 12 American service members are already gone. 12 families now live in a world divided between the time before the knock on the door and the time after it. And those aren't statistics. Those are lives that cannot be returned to their mothers or fathers or children. War hawks circle like vultures over a battlefield they will never have to see. Men like Tom Cotton and Lindsey Graham, who speak of this conflict with the kind of certainty that only men far from the consequences possess. They talk about it as if war were a sacrament, as if bombs were holy water and the blood of soldiers were just the price of some sacred geopolitical mandate. They speak as though war is simple. But war is never simple. War is a young man in Arkansas who will never again hear the sound of his child's voice. War is a mother sitting at a kitchen table staring at a folded flag and wondering why the men who ordered this war can't even explain what victory is supposed to look like. War is the quiet humiliation of a country that cannot afford to keep its rural hospitals open, but somehow finds $1 billion a day to burn on a conflict that cannot even name its own purpose. And in towns across this country, clinics are closing. Families are losing health care. Grocery bills climb higher each week while wages stand still like an old tired horse at the edge of a dry field. And somewhere in Washington, men will speak solemnly about the price of defending freedom. But the American people understand sacrifice. We always have. What we do not understand is how an administration that campaigned against endless wars now finds itself steering the country directly into one. We do not understand how leaders who promised restraint now speak the language of escalation. What's even more troubling is the absence of something that every war must have if it is to mean anything at all, a plan. But there is no clear objective. There's no defined end state, no explanation of what success looks like or how it should be achieved. Instead, there are shifting explanations, the contradictory briefings, and the uneasy sense that the people in charge are improvising their way through a crisis that grows larger with every passing day. This is what happens when a nation slides into war, not through necessity, but through momentum. And it's exactly the kind of war the framers of the Constitution feared most. Because they had seen kings send armies across oceans on whims and pride and ambition, and they had watched entire generations sacrifice to the vanity of men who believed themselves chosen by history. Because the framers understood something we seem to forget every generation or so. War is the most serious decision a nation can make. And it's precisely why the men who built this country feared war placed in the hands of a single administration. They understood that ambition and pride in politics would tempt leaders to gamble with the lives of ordinary people. So they did something radical for their time. They placed the power to send this nation into war, not in the hands of a president or a cabinet, but in the hands of Congress. The representatives of the people who would pay the price in blood and treasure, they knew that if the nation were forced to debate war openly, if every elected official had to stand before their constituents and defend that decision, then war would remain what it is meant to be, the absolute last resort of a free people, not the impulsive tool of politicians who are searching for enemies abroad while their own country struggles at home. But now wars begin with briefings and press conferences instead of declarations and votes, and the American people are asked to accept the consequences without ever being asked for their consent. But history has a way of keeping score. We deserve better than weak men in expensive suits who talk about war as if it is a theory instead of a graveyard. We deserve better than leaders who posture like toy soldiers while sending other people's children to fight and die. And across this country, families are already carrying more than they should ever have to bear. In Alabama and Arkansas and every small town that never makes the evening news, parents will sit at kitchen tables choosing between the light bill and a doctor visit, between groceries and prescriptions, between dignity and survival. Clinics are closing. Wages are standing still. Hope gets a little thinner each day. Yet somehow there is always $1 billion for war. There's always another shipment of weapons for allies whose citizens seem to enjoy health care and education and security that many Americans can only dream about. We are told to sacrifice for stability abroad while the grip tightens around the throats of working people here at home. And a government that asks its people to endure hardship while pouring endless wealth into wars and foreign alliances has forgotten the most basic duty of a republic. The American people deserve leaders who remember that the strength of a nation begins not on some distant battlefield, but in the lives of the people it was created to serve. The bombs may fall 1,000 miles from here. The speeches may sound confident and strong, and the war hawks will pound their chests and speak of destiny and resolve, but eventually the bill comes due. It arrives at gas pumps and grocery stores and hospital closures and empty chairs at family dinner tables. It arrives in the quiet grief of parents who will never again hear their child's voice. And when that bill arrives, the American people should remember who wrote it. We should remember the men who beat the drums. We should remember the voices that demanded escalation. We should remember who spoke with caution and who spoke with reckless certainty, because war has a gravity that rhetoric can't escape. And sooner or later, the weight of it always comes home. And when it does, the country will have to decide whether it will continue to drift into wars of choice or whether it will reclaim the wisdom written into its founding documents, whether the power to send Americans into battle belongs to a few men in Washington or to the nation itself. The founders understood the danger that war should be rare, war should be deliberate, war should be debated openly before the first shot is ever fired. Anything less is not strength. It is surrender to the oldest and most dangerous temptation of power. And we deserve better than that.
Wait. Robert Arnold comments on the issues of the day in that Southern Arkansas drawl. His words paint pictures and tug at our hearts. Let us know if you would like to hear more or search for him on TikTok.
And that's our show this week. We're asking our labor partners, locals, and regional officers to seriously consider underwriting this show, because Working Voices and KPFK could really use your support. If you value this program and the information we bring to you and the other programs that make this station like no other, please contact the station at 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. to explore the possibilities of a generous contribution or a sustaining monthly investment. We need to hear from you. Email your comments or questions to workingvoices@aol.com. Please contribute if you can at 818-985-5735. This is Jamie Campbell of OPIU Local 30. Our thanks to Steve Zeltzer, Dan McCrory, Gary Scott, Hal Lohr, Enrique Sanchez, Terry Haley, and our guests. Please continue to give what you can to keep us going. We're in this together, and of course, always remember to advocate, agitate, and organize.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO, and we'll take care of everything.
I'm S.D. Chandler from Middle East in Focus. Author Phyllis Bennis will be discussing Understanding Palestine and Israel at Midnight Books on Friday, March 27th, and at Watermelon Books on Sunday, March 29th. Co-sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace Los Angeles, the Institute for Policy Studies, and KPFK. Further information available.